The Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the 500. In the early morning hours, the gates are opened to a waiting crowd. This could be race day, or the time trials, or almost any bright sunny day in the month of May. For where there are race cars and drivers, there are people. Hundreds of thousands of people who walk or ride through the gates of the Speedway to draw close and worship at this shrine of American high speed. They get as close as they can, and they are fascinated by the beauty and complexity of these machines that virtually fly on the ground. It's a love affair that has endured for more than 60 years. And while times and customs change, each new generation continues to find race cars and the men who drive them as fascinating as did their fathers before them. Wherein lies the appeal of the driver to the spectator? Is it the machine he drives? Is it because he respects God and country? Or because he loves his mother? He certainly shares with most of us the love of money. He's a businessman, and he is, outwardly at least, the calmest man on the racetrack. He may be 5'6", but here he is 10 feet tall. He may look like a cowboy, but his steed has the strength of 800 horses. The race driver practices his profession under the watchful eyes of virtually millions of people. But he must be ready to concentrate completely on the task at hand, excluding everything about him which could detract from a superior performance. He drives in isolation, alone. And yet, he is part of a group of 33 individuals. 33 men. And they have a long way to go. This is the way it looks most of the year, a great speedway waiting for the sound of engines and the happy confusion of people. Then in late April, the race drivers arrive, and soon after, the crowds. New race cars start their high-speed life under the watchful eyes of mechanics and designers. They come here from far away, and the magnet that draws them is the richest prize in auto racing. There are 81 entries. The fastest 33 will earn for their owners and drivers a share of the $1 million purse. And the amount of each share? Well, that's what it's all about. Like children taking first steps, new cars roll onto the track. Like a bird learning to fly, a rookie driver must learn the ways of high speed at Indianapolis, and he is lucky if he has an older brother to help him. Their name is Bettenhausen. And their name is Unser. Bobby and Al Unser have both won the 500, but Al has within his grasp the chance of a lifetime to be the first three-time consecutive winner in history. His car, like those of his teammates, was designed with futuristic V-shaped dihedral wings by Maurice Philippe for the Parnelli-Jones racing team. A combination of airfoils and the dihedral wings produces high-speed stability. But somewhere, at least on Al's car, 10 miles of critical top speed is missing. And so, with time already short, the decision is made to remove them on all four cars. The change is immediate and startling. Speeds climb, and under the sharp edge of competition, a pattern emerges. And then the mistakes begin. Since the day that the Speedway opened in 1909, there have been accidents. High speed is not the cause, for speed is relative. Mechanical failure and human error are the chief factors, and so you try to get as much safety help as possible to offset this. Mario Andretti remembers his fiery crash of 1969. He wears fire-retardant clothing. His helmet and car, like those of his competitors, has been certified after exhaustive tests and inspection. The concept of high-speed safety is almost a science at the 500. Men in a wide variety of safety equipment wait for the moment when they might be needed, even if it's only tow service for a car that just won't go. But all the engineering and high-speed know-how of the racing fraternity has never been able to do anything about Indianapolis weather. Late in the afternoon on the first day of qualifications, the sky cleared. A.J. Foyt went out to qualify and blew an engine. So much for May 13th, 1972. The 14th started off with Steve Kriseloff on the track. He slid a total of 500 feet. There was minor damage to the car, the driver okay. 2:46 p.m. Bill Vukovich visited the wall in turn one. He had just turned a record lap of 185.797. Joe Leonard, the defending United States Auto Club champion and winner of the California 500, wheels onto the track in the first of Parnelli Jones team cars. In four fast qualifying laps, he turns a new record average of 185.223. That's almost 14 miles per hour faster than his 1968 pole-winning speed. On the track, Mario Andretti, the 1969 Indianapolis winner and three-time national champion. His qualifying speed, 187.617. Another new record. He drives down the same street his father used to drive. Gary Bettenhausen, a record, 188.877. Bobby Unser, 1968 Indianapolis winner, does what everyone has been expecting, 195.940, shatters all existing records, and boosts last year's full speed by 17 miles per hour. The gentleman from Wichita Falls, Texas, Lloyd Ruby, turns in a four-lap average of 181.415. He'll start the race in the fourth row. Now it's Tuesday, May 16th. Art Pollard has already qualified for the race. Then, on this midweek practice run, a right rear hub broke. A wheel came off, and the car virtually destroyed. How do you race a car that looks like this? Well, the magicians of Gasoline Alley have been answering that question for 60 years. It's called hard work and no sleep. While mechanics ply their trade, still to qualified drivers get in more running time. Al Unser circles the track in Parnelli's third team car. Sometimes a driver needs a new perspective, so study the others and see what you're doing right or wrong. Saturday brings the final 2 days of qualifying. There are 21 spots left, and Mark Donahue of Newton Square, Pennsylvania, claims one. His speed, 191.408. Peter Revson wins the remaining front row place with 192.885. Then Al Unser. At 32, he has already accomplished more than most racers do in a lifetime. His lap speeds, all in the 183-mile-per-hour bracket, are not what he wanted. But at this point, he is very happy to settle for 19th starting place. Mike Mosley pushes to 189 miles per hour, and this is not what he wanted. considering he had practiced consistently over 190. Still from his 16th starting position, he looks back on two Indianapolis winners. In the statistics, Jerry Grant is no longer rated as the heaviest 500 driver. His consistent year-long diet may have had something to do with a near record of 189.294. Then, of course, there is the yearly drama of the man on the bubble. His name is Cale Yarbrough, and his speed of 178.864, ironically faster than last year's pole, is the slowest of the field. He waits out the agonizing minutes till 6 p.m. as driver after driver tries and fails to bump him out of the race. The seconds tick away. It's all over. The 1972 starting field is filled. Three names to paint on the long pit wall, while people who have worked all month take a day off. It's a real Texas barbecue, and the host, well, you might expect, is Lloyd Ruby and his sponsor, Gene White. That is not Gene White. His name is Agajanian. You may have heard of him. Race officials, bank presidents, photographers, wives, news writers, car builders, drivers, pretty girls, speedway personnel, and car designers consume untold ears of corn and 800 pounds of barbecued ribs. The sun is gone. At twilight, the track is empty, lonely, but it waits for daybreak and another 500. The lights in Gasoline Alley burn all night. The mechanics are always the last to finish their work. At 5 a.m. on race day, there are 10,000 people inside the track hard at work, and perhaps 250,000 outside waiting to come in. The lights in Gasoline Alley still burn. Now in each garage, there is a USAC official. He'll stay with his assigned car until after the race. That's the way it is at Indianapolis. Everything you do is under the close scrutiny of officials and the crowds of people. If you have a product like tires, then you'd better be sure they'll perform safely and dependably in the spotlight of public attention. That was the original idea behind the Speedway when it was built, as a proving ground for automotive products. The sun is up. The cars are pushed from Gasoline Alley to the track. There is nothing now but the race. Voigt's car refuses to start. Agonizing moments go by. Voigt is pushed over a starting line he crossed three times in victory. Andretti moves down and pushes into second spot behind Bobby Unser. Oh. 33, driven by Saul Qualper, is the first car out of the race. Transmission failure. Bobby Unser has widened his lead. Donahue, Remsen, Bettenhausen, and Andretti behind him. The speed climbs into the high 170s as the field settles down for the long ride. Six laps down, Peter Revson coasts slowly through turn two, out of the race. From every observer's post comes the word Bobby Unser is slowing down and coming into the pits. At 30 laps, his domination of the race ends. Just a little thing, like a broken distributor, sidelines a champion. Gary Bettenhausen leads now. Mike Mosley has moved up from 16th to 2nd. And Mario Andretti is pushed to his pit out of fuel. Donahue and Jerry Grant in the pits on the 40th lap leave at the same time. It's Donahue that almost hits the pylon. That pit apron just isn't wide enough. Joe Leonard makes his first routine stop of the race. He's been running in the top 10 since the start. Andretti, now refueled, is ready to go also. It's a drag race all the way to the first turn. Johnny Rutherford goes wide in turn one, but saves it. And Mike Mosley moves into the lead. It's the 54th lap, and he starts his run for victory. In the 56th lap, he's running strong. Through turn one, two, three, and then turn four. Mosley crashed twice in turn four a year ago. Today, once more. And this time, while leading the race. It was mechanical failure, pure and simple. But from such coincidences, superstitions are born. The race slows. Mosley is singed, but all right. And there's a mess to clean up. Now the new caution light system comes into play. Lights set for under 100 miles per hour keep the field in position. If you saw a number three when the light went on, and you've slowed to the proper speed, you should see a number three all around the track. If you see another number, you're going too fast or too slow. In the pits, a moment of confusion. Bettenhausen is leaving as Donahue arrives. Traffic is heavy, as it almost always is during a caution light. Unser makes his second stop and is on his way in 22 seconds as the remains of a beautiful race car are taken to the garage area. Gary Bettenhausen has the lead again. Gordon Johncock, Revson's teammate, comes through the pit. An exhaust valve has sidelined him and his dreams. There's no time to find a body shop during the 500, but Lloyd Ruby has a missing nose wing. He pulls in. The rest is an exercise in coordination and pre-planning. Jerry Grant, running quietly, suddenly moves into the lead as Bettenhausen pulls into the pits. It's the 162nd lap. Jerry Grant experiences that wonderful sensation for the first time, leading the Indianapolis 500. Grant knows he must still make a pit stop, but just maybe he can catch Bettenhausen, who has taken back the lead and has Joe Leonard breathing down his neck. Grant blasts back into the battle. His crew checks the remains of 350 gallons of fuel. Jerry had better have enough to finish the race. Bettenhausen is running a few seconds ahead of Grant. And then, Bettenhausen is moving to the inside, coasting as Jerry Grant goes back into the lead. Mark Donahue moves up to second place. Al Unser is third, Joe Leonard fourth. And now there's an element of confusion. Gurney believes Grant is a lap ahead of Donahue, so they tell him to slow down and save fuel. Bobby desperately tries to project himself into the car with Grant to help him into winner's circle. Donahue moves up on Grant, and they give him the go sign. A short distance away, a large checkered platform waits, but for only one winning car. It's the 188th lap. Grant, in a surprise move, comes into the pits. He has a vibrating wheel. In order to better deal with the situation, Gurney directs him into Bobby's vacant pit. But the damage is done when the pit crew routinely connect up the fuel hose, Bobby's fuel hose, to Grant's car. You can't do that and stay in the race. Grant chases Donahue, but there's a spin in the short chute. Just enough to turn on the caution light, and there's only a few laps to go. Donahue and Grant are locked in position. Donahue is one full lap ahead, and Jerry can't do anything about it. And Donahue may have a fuel problem. The green flag, but it's too late for Grant. He passes Donahue, unlapping himself as they move into the 199th lap. And then the finish. Grant over the line first, but in reality almost a minute behind the winning Donahue. Al Unser is a strong third, at least for the moment. Now a young man from Pennsylvania moves into a winner's circle in Indiana. He actually slowed down to win, detuning the engine so that he could be sure the car would go the distance. At that, it's a new record of 163.465 for the 500 miles. And Mario Andretti, well, he was still moving at the end, but he was coasting out of fuel. Mark Donahue got a ride in the pace car, his pace car. And Gary Bettenhausen got a ride, too, at the end of a tow rope. Al Unser pulled in, his chance to become the first three-time consecutive winner in Indianapolis 500 history is gone. Soon he learns that Grant's disqualification down to 12th place has put him into second, but that still isn't first, and that was what Al wanted. Gurney's judgment on that critical pit stop probably cost Jerry his position in the race and quite a bundle of money. When you're a crew chief, you make decisions. You try to be right, but regardless, you live with the consequences. For people who can't make decisions never get to be crew chief, and they don't win races either. Well, Jerry Grant may well get another chance. And Al Unser and his brother Bobby, well, they've got three Indianapolis wins between them, and they're still not satisfied. That's because they are two of the 33 men who go 500 miles.